from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news. Broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at scaredmonkeysradio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
Okay, good evening, everyone. I'm reading an article. Yes, I can read. Some of you that listen think I can't. It's by former district attorney and legal commentator and author Robin Sachs. I'm not sure if you've heard of her or not. I think I have. And it says, Baby Vaughn Court Battle. What happened to the best interest of the child? Why do some states care about the best interest of the child and others do not? So I thought, why don't I track down this Robin Sachs person, bring her on the show, and we can talk about Baby Vaughn. And welcome, Robin Sachs. Nice to meet you.
Thank you. Nice to meet you, Dana. I've heard so many wonderful things. It's like we've been talking for years.
You know, we've done this before, these adoption cases that turned into a nightmare for the adoptive parent. I hope I'm saying that right. And this case is very similar. Let's talk about keeping Grayson home.
Well, you know, this is another case. It's interesting. You kind of look at the world of crime and advocacy, kind of dealing with heinous acts of abuse, stalking, murder, missing people, the stuff that becomes the nuts and bolts of our life day in, day out. And yet there's a whole other part of the justice system that is not in the criminal justice system, and it's not technically even in the normal civil system. Instead, it is, within the family court system, buried in there are these adoption cases. And, you know, what it really comes down to is we are finding that there are more cases and more scenarios of adoptions in the United States going south than almost anywhere else, which is part of the reason why people probably choose not to adopt children here in the United States, which is so unfortunate because there are so many children right here on this soil, or I know it's not quite your soil, but close enough, that could be adopted here. But because of the legal loopholes and the lack of best interest of the child and kind of looking at the child, adoptions go awry.
Yeah, and you're right, and we've talked about this before. If you're just tuning in, Robin Sachs is here. Check out her webpage at robinsachs.com. So let's get into the story a little bit. The mom, Drusilla, I'm not even going to try and pronounce the last name, decided to give up her child, conceived while she was having an extramarital affair. She terminated her parental rights to allow the adoptive parents to adopt the baby through Ohio. Now, if I remember correctly, the last story you and I covered on this, Ohio again. Am I wrong?
You got it, actually. No, that's what kind of been part of the alarm, what sent the alarm bells off for me and other advocates on behalf of adoptive parents, and not just adoptive parents. This is not a, you know, blanket adoptive parents rule, and that's kind of one of the big problems that is coming out right now, at least in the articles and the responses to articles and the media that does get out there. It becomes the appearance of having a push-pull between biological father's rights versus adoptive parents' rights, and somehow that's how it's being categorized, or that's how it's categorized. That's not what this is about. What this is about is cases, and two of them happen to have originated in Ohio, where there is a state that allows for open adoption, which means that both the person, the biological parent, mother who is putting their child up for adoption, could be both parents, and the prospective adoptive parent or parents are able to know who each other is or are, depending on the number of people, and that they mutually pick each other. It's kind of a dating service where both people pick each other and a happy relationship is supposed to begin. And there is, because of the rights of fathers in Ohio, which I absolutely agree that fathers should have rights and biological dads are important, but what has happened is that instead of the father's right being used to actually advocate for the best interest of the child, it's almost that father's rights are being used to not advocate for what the biological mother wanted. So it's almost a, well, if you wanted A, then we want B, but we're going to call it father's rights.
Yeah, it's all nutty. And for those that are wondering more about this case, there's a link in the show notes, keepinggraysonhome.com. Now, let's get into the process itself, Robin. Going through the process of the adoption, and you have this child, baby, two-year-old, three-year-old, whatever, and are you telling me then that 2 years, 3 years, whatever later, the biological father can come forward and basically the adoptive parents are thrown out in the wind?
Well, in this case, I don't want to misquote. I mean, this was a case in which the biological father did put his name on the registry within short order of Grayson's birth, something like a period of within 17 days or so, which is different than the Doss case, baby Doss case, D-O-S-S, which is the other one that's in Ohio. And the fact of the matter is that there is a period of time in which they have a right to list themselves. I believe it is a year in Ohio. And it's at that point that they can, you know, assert those rights within the year. But what people don't recognize is you assert the rights within the year. And in this case, the biological father asserted the rights early. But because of the different legal machinations that go on and this child who's in flux, the court battles can last for so long that at some point the rights of both parties get fought out all the way through. Now, some people would argue that the Vaughns, at the second that the birth father surfaced, should have immediately given up baby Vaughn and then allowed for Grayson to go with the biological father. And my next group of articles that I plan on writing is going to actually talk about the concerns and reasons why the birth mother was concerned with who the father was and what history that would make this person not a fit parent. Just because you have the seed doesn't mean that you should breed.
Again, Robin Sachs is here, and we're talking about an adoptive case, bringing Grayson home. And the child is being bounced around through the courts. The court process itself is confusing at best, but when do the rights of the child come into play? Psychologists, have they sat down and looked at the possible damage? This child's 3 years old now and very impressionable. What are the doctors saying, Robin?
Well, that's exactly the problem. Everybody, it is uniform and agreed upon that the early formative years in a child's life are the times in which the attachment begins with mom. From day one, the people who raise the child from the moment where the attachment and bond and trust are made is starts at minute one. And each and every day from the date of birth on, the attachment grows stronger and deeper. So whether people agreed or not that Grayson stayed with the Vaughn family at the beginning, the fact of the matter is after 3 years, he is connected and bonded to his parents, who are the Vaughns. And so at this point, ripping him out of the home that he knows is going to, for sure, through the reports of all the psychologists and everyone uniformly agrees, will for sure cause irreparable harm to him. I mean, you're talking about a three-year-old. What kind of trust in life, what kind of stability are you going to have when mommy and daddy were taken away from you at 3 years old?
Yeah, exactly. Robin Sachs is here, and we're talking about the baby Vaughn case. Where is this now in the courts? I'm seeing some news stories that has Grayson actually been turned over?
No, he has not been turned over. The turnover date is October 30th. But I want to make one point that just shows how little the state of Ohio cares about the best interests of Grayson and other children in this situation. Here you have a situation where everybody's talking about turnover dates and father's rights and adoptive parents' rights and filing in of orders and so forth. But the fact of the matter is that the second that there was a determination that the courts were inclined to turn Grayson over, you would think that their immediate plan of action would be, let's find a transition plan. Let's figure out what's going to make this the most healthy, psychologically beneficial to Grayson himself. And not only did that argument not come from the court, where you didn't see the judge actually make a finding that there should be a transition. But the argument actually came from Jason Vaughn, who is Grayson's dad, adoptive dad, and who said, listen, if this is what's going to happen, don't you guys think we should do something to prepare this child?
Yeah.
And it was like, yeah, that's probably not a bad idea. And if it wasn't for Jason, the courts could have cared less about the best interests of Grayson.
Is there an appeal process, or has that all been exhausted?
No, it's there are appeals, there are emergency appeals. I'm hoping that we'll start seeing some motions filed on behalf of Grayson right now. The thing that's so outrageous here is that, you know, you have a situation that this was a mom who made a determination that she was not going to have a child. This could have been a child that she could have easily had aborted, but instead chose to put this baby up for adoption to be able to give it a life. And so this is someone who didn't want to have a child, who is now a party to this action, who too is being traumatized through this process. And that's what's so sad, is that everybody right now is having to fight for their rights and hopefully fight for Grayson's rights and not forget that in between.
Again, for those of you listening either live or on the podcast, the website keepinggraysonhome.com. There's a link in the show notes, and Robin's website is robinsacks.com, and we'll stay on top of that story. Let's talk a little bit about something that you have been reporting on and getting some flack about, Oksana and Mel Gibson, the marriage counselor's dream.
Oh, my Lord. Let me tell you, that case is just, you know, talk about an annuity of a case for TMZ and for all the rest of us. Yes, I am getting a ton of flack on that case, and it's very interesting. First of all, I wrote an article for Women in Crime, Inc. yesterday where I said that Oksana needs reputation rehab, and I took the position that I still stand by, which I do believe Oksana is a victim of domestic violence.
Yep.
I do believe the evidence against her is overwhelming. I have had the opportunity to talk to various detectives, and of course I've been called out for not naming the detectives. Well, I'm not going to name my nice private secret in the sheriff's department because I don't want to get them fired.
Yeah.
But I do know that the evidence against him is substantial. But what I also know is that the fact of the matter is that the prosecutors have a duty to be able to determine the likelihood of conviction. And in determining the likelihood of a conviction against Mel Gibson, if TMZ is any sort of indicator, Camp Oksana's got some serious problems. And when I had the very short-lived, I don't know if I want to call it honor, but the short-lived duty of working on that team, I had a very clear and concise PR plan, and that was, there is no PR. Media is shut down. This is a case to be fought in the courtroom. This is a case to be presented to the DAs and for the evidence to speak to itself. Every single time that Lisa Bloom or, Dan Horowitz or anybody else freely, voluntarily gets quoted on TMZ or submits documents, it is just fervor for Camp Mel to go crazy.
Yeah.
And it's been an unbelievable example of how PR has changed the tides in criminal justice.
I couldn't agree more. So you're one of the 50 lawyers, are you?
39 was what the quote was.
Or is it
of Thursday? It is 41 now, I think. Yes,
41.
I was listed on TMZ. Although, I got to tell you, that wasn't necessarily nearly as exciting as Perez Hilton commenting on my departure from the DA's office. So.
Yeah, I had to laugh. Oh, you're right. It was 40. I said 50. But it may be 50 by the time this is all settled. Robin Sachs is here, former DA, author, victims advocate, and one of Oksana's 41 lawyers, fodder on TMZ.com. Harvey Levin, he's a lawyer, too. He should be not giving you guys a hard time. Listen, before we finish here, we got about 5 or 6 minutes left. We're going to be covering some domestic violence issues. October is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Your thoughts, how have the media been doing covering that?
You know, I haven't really been seeing the media doing anything in terms of domestic violence month as of late, other than the reporting on Mel Gibson and Oksana, and that's not really looked upon as a domestic violence case. So I haven't seen anything. The one thing that I would like to see, though, is the Rihannas and, you know, other victims of domestic violence to come out and rally for this very important issue, especially because I was at a magnificent conference yesterday in which what many people don't realize that the VAWA, which is the Violence Against Women's Act, is up right now for reconsideration. It's being reenacted into federal legislation, and it needs to be renewed. And it's a very important issue, and though we've come a long way, baby, it's really more like we've come a long way, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, you're right, and we haven't heard very much of it. The media seems to pick a topic, focus on it, and then run like hell with it. And it is an important topic. We're going to continue on tonight talking with it. Robin Sachs is here. Yeah, you've updated your webpage a little bit with the Sachs Facts, and we now see a video compilation of that, which I think you're doing a great job on. Tell us a little bit about that before we finish up.
Well, you know, so often, as you guys know, you find yourself wanting to pontificate or express opinions on various subjects, but you don't really get the ability to do so on the national television shows because they have a spot and a topic, and you're kind of confined to it. And so what better way to voice yourself than utilizing every medium out there in the media? And so I think I've saturated the market with my written word. And how much more fun to get my personality, my real personality, not just a 30-second-in-a-box personality, but where you can see me in the comfort of my own office, being able to say what I want to say in unedited format, and or slightly edited format, and using all the four-letter words that I want. So that's what Sachs TV is. It's a weekly little blast on whatever's on my mind.
Yeah, it's robinsachs.com. Robin, good job as always. We'll see you again soon.
Likewise. Take care. Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. That's former ADA author and victims advocate, NBC News analyst, and one of Oksana's 39 lawyers, Robin Sachs, here talking about the Baby Vaughn court case. And again, check out that webpage at www.keepinggraysonhome.com. Grayson is Grayson, home.com. To learn more about this interesting case of an adoptive parent losing custody of their child to a birthright father. And it seems like Ohio, I don't know, has a crappy reputation when it comes to that. In fact, even the Ohio legislature is looking at the law saying, you know, we have to do something different. My name is Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. In a minute or two, we'll be back with Blink from Blink on Crime to get some updates on some cases, in particular the Hartley case, you know, the one that jet ski riders in Mexico, where the husband was allegedly shot by pirates and the wife has been going through lots of interrogation. Well, Blinkster will be here to talk about that case and others in just a minute here on Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. Yes, that is me, Dana Pretzer. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and on the line is our sister blog, the blogstress. No, I don't even know if that's a word. The blogmeister, the blinkster from blinkoncrime.com. How are you, ma'am?
Good evening, Dana. I'm well. How are you?
I'm good. You know, listen, I got the day off tomorrow, and I was thinking you and I could get on our jet skis and go ride this jet ski in the lake down in Mexico. I'll bring my vest. You bring your AK-47. We should be all right.
Well, you know, I know how to shoot one now.
No, you know, I'm laughing, but this is a tragic story. Of course, the Hartley case. What's been going on? I know you've been all over it like a bird on a bug.
It is very tragic. Allegedly, David Hartley, a young man looking to relocate to Colorado, was allegedly murdered by members of a Mexican cartel. When I say allegedly a lot during this conversation, it's because the gentleman has not been recovered,
right.
And he hasn't, nor has his jet ski. And frankly, there's no physical evidence to confirm the widow's account, the widow being Tiffany Hartley, his wife of 8 years. And she's been on just about every national show, the media, you know, junket, as we like to call it, since this happened. Most recently, which would have been last Thursday and Friday, Friday and Monday, she was interviewed for about 16 hours at the Mexican consulate in McAllen, Texas.
Right.
Which is where they, the couple was most recently living, having relocated from Reynosa, which was much closer to where, well, it was in Mexico. It was where David was actually working.
Now, when we see the story, and you know where I'm going with this, 16 hours of interrogation and bang, you're on TV right away. Yeah, what are your thoughts of that?
Well, my thoughts, I have a, you know, having done this work for some time, my hinky meter went through the roof first time I saw her on TV.
Hinky meter.
And I say that because I'm gonna be accountable for the fact that I was probably, if not the first, media source to question her story.
Right.
I don't take lightly the fact that both on the Texas side and on the Mexican side, these people are living with sincere violence in these areas. This cartel that they're referring to is heavy duty. And as has been told to me by one of the Blink editors, actually lives very close to this and has spent a significant amount of time border crossing in her work as well as her husband's. And these are very real situations. So I don't want, I want to be clear on that, because there are many people that are very upset saying that, you know, perhaps questioning her story means there's no commitment to the fact that there is a sincere problem with border violence. The Falcon Lake, which is, it shares a Texas side just south of Zapata, and also on the Mexican side. So the border really goes straight down the 60-mile lake. You cross over it, you're on the Mexican side.
Right.
The reality is, according to Tiffany Hartley, this couple was well aware of the dangers that were associated with what had been going on this lake on the Mexican side. The reality is they made a choice and crossed over into that country. So for me to, when I say that, I'm not discounting the border issues, but this isn't one of them. What we have is Americans trespassing on Mexican water.
Right.
And that aside, if Mr. Hartley is a victim, then we need to find out, like we would in any other investigation, what happened and bring the perpetrators to justice. That may be out of our hands if it truly is a Mexican issue in terms of them having jurisdiction. I'm being told that the Border Patrol has very little activity on this case from the U.S. side, and mm-hmm. my sources are telling me that this is an ATF and a DEA issue, and they are on full alert. And when I hear that, as you're probably ahead of me when I said those words, there's more going on, mm-hmm. perhaps, than we can appreciate. And I don't mean just in Miss Hartley's story. I can't say that what she's saying happened didn't happen. I can say with a reasonable level of certainty what she's saying happened did not happen that way.
Let's talk about that. And if you're just tuning in, sure. Blink from Blink on Crime is here. Check out their webpage at blinkoncrime.com. And I laughed a bit when you said your hinky meter. Mine too. No one could dispute the fact that Mexico is a crazy place to be with the cartels and the drug problems. And, you know, I've said it many times, the border patrol guys are probably the most underpaid, the most underappreciated and doing the most dangerous job of any law enforcement officer anywhere.
I agree with that.
But here we've got a case, and all you have to do, you don't have to be Blank from Blink on Crime or Dana Pretzer or Clint Van Zandt or anyone to just look at the facts that we're hearing, assuming allegedly that this is what happened. But now we've got his blood droplets on her life vest or her water vest.
We don't know that.
But yeah, and
that
was my next point, is that, or do we? Because that's what's been reported, but is that accurate?
Well, I can tell you that I, as a member of the media, I was given the heads up one day last week that those results were expected. Well, let me back up a little bit, because let's talk chain of evidence. That vest was not, nothing was taken into evidence the way, and I can't speak to other countries, I can only speak to ours, how we process a crime scene.
Right.
And that would include Ms. Hartley's vest, that would include the jet ski, that would include the clothing she was wearing. She was not checked for GS gunshot residue. She was not asked to you know, attend an interview where they would have brought her a change of clothing, taken her clothing. You know, not that she in any way should be considered a suspect, but this is how we treat a missing person. She's alleged that there's been a homicide.
Sure.
She's a victim. She's an eyewitness to a homicide. She allegedly said she touched and attempted to put her husband onto the jet ski, so she's now touched a murder victim.
Mm-hmm.
And she's a walking piece of physical evidence, and none of that was done. As a matter of fact, I isolated an image in the parking lot of the sheriff of the press walking around her jet ski.
Yeah, and this, of course, the circumstances are different, but it just harkens back to Aruba and other cases that we've heard of from Mexico and overseas, where you get police work 101, what we look at here in North America and to other places. And I can just think of my friend Dog Chapman and what he went through in Mexico. It's a different land down there, and you got to wonder just how seriously they're taking this case. What is the Mexican government saying?
Well, I think that the Mexican government is taking it a little more seriously than we did at first. And I'm going to probably get some heat for that, because the missing persons missing persons file, the request of the Mexican government to investigate her husband's disappearance, was not filed for the first 8 days. And you see Sheriff Siggy Gonzalez, who is the sheriff of Zapata County, who has been up in arms for a number of years for not getting appropriate funding for his area because of some of the issues,
right.
Screaming, you know, it's the cartel, it's the this, and it, I'm not saying 100% that it's not. I mean, we have an investigator who we're getting two stories. We're getting one that he was not involved whatsoever in the Hartley case, and on the other hand, that he was. You know, Tiffany Hartley has said she sat next to this guy whose head ended up in a suitcase.
Yeah, jeez.
Now, if you understand, and I am no expert, this is not what I would call my strength of field, but in our research, if you study even, you know, superficially the cartel, it is not their MO to bring attention to themselves in this way, in terms of killing an American tourist. This would be high, it doesn't fit their profile.
Yeah, and you're right. And you bring up the point as far as law enforcement goes. It's amazing that anyone even stays in that job down there, because literally you can lose your head.
True, I can understand to a degree Sheriff Gonzalez's concerns and kind of the knee-jerk reaction that he had. But if that's how you feel, I question why you don't process a crime scene appropriately.
Exactly.
First of all, he has no jurisdiction.
Yeah.
So what needed to happen is the appropriate agency that had jurisdiction needed to be called in. And I mention that for a couple of reasons. Tiffany Hartley says that her husband was shot in the forehead. Now, over the last couple of days, I've seen that actually change. But in this case, which is receiving so much coverage, sometimes it's difficult to understand what's being interpreted by the reporter.
Right.
And, you know, the day of us investigative journalists is dead, except for maybe five.
Mm-hmm.
Nobody's asking the obvious questions. And I'll give you an example of what I mean. I spent an hour this afternoon speaking to a specialist, marketing specialist for Sea-Doo Watercraft. In this particular instance, it's the RXT model, which is what they both had. They had the same jet skis. In this particular model, there's a kill switch, which would mean while they're riding it, there should be a lanyard, whether that's attached around their neck, that connects to the key, or their arm, what have you. That is standard protocol when operating this vessel. So if he were to be shot and flip over the jet ski, as Ms. Hartley suggests, if he's wearing the key, immediately that jet ski gets cut off,
right,
the engine, and it has a smart chip in the lanyard as well as the starter. So that jet ski isn't good to anyone unless they recover David with the lanyard and then use it to start the jet ski to get out of there. So that's the first issue. The second is, and I've seen pictures of him jet skiing, and not once is that lanyard connected. It's very common for people that are getting in and out of the water, perhaps jumping off of the vessel,
right,
to not wear the lanyard. So they're keeping the key and the lanyard connected at the starter. So if he's shot off of the watercraft, and as she tells it, he would have been at a full throttle. So that means that unit, that jet ski, is going as fast as it takes the throttle to back off in the direction that the handlebars were facing. So where's the jet ski?
Yeah. Hey, well, what about this?
I'm sorry.
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
No, in addition, we know from the four or five different reports what type of weapons these alleged pirates are using, and they're automatic weapons or AK-47s. It is extremely difficult to get a kill shot, what I'll call a kill shot, without any other evidence of hitting anything.
Yeah.
With three moving boats, and these, keep in mind, these jet skis open up to 30 miles an hour in 1.7 seconds. So they're, and with a top end speed of 70 miles an hour versus these rinky-dink boats that go maybe 15 to 20 miles an hour. So much of this really, just from a technical perspective, doesn't make sense. When I was speaking to the gentleman this afternoon, I said to him, well, how hard is it to sink one of these? And he said, emphatically, virtually impossible. Regular gunfire, you're not sinking it. It's compartmentalized. The hull is compartmentalized exactly like a boat.
Right.
The Coast Guard specifications for these units are exactly like a vessel. And he personally has never seen one sink completely. He said even if something happened whereby, an AK-47 would actually cut the hull in half. Well, certainly you would see splintered fiberglass.
Yeah.
All over. There's just, the point is, as the story is told, it seems to me that if you look at the totality of the improbabilities associated with it, it really needs further scrutiny, in my opinion.
Absolutely. Blink from Blink on Crime is here, and just that evidence alone, like you say, and I'm teasing you a little bit about your hinky meter, will make anyone's hinky meter go a little bit crazy. Listen, before I let you go, looking at your webpage, again, for everyone listening live or on the podcast, blinkoncrime.com, I want to get a quick 2-minute comment from you on the murder of Morgan Harrington 1 year later.
Well, I'm very... I'm frustrated that there's not been an arrest in this case. The family is absolutely gracious in their endurance while this investigative work is going on. We've learned so much from this case, but the bottom line is we have a vicious rapist and killer walking among private citizens who is tied to a vicious rape from 5 years ago. We know we have a repeat offender, and frankly, if following Morgan's case has been heightened by certainly the murder of Yardley Love, but there is a rash of rapes and attacks on this campus.
Right.
We've covered them. We've reported the fact that the McCleary Act requires UVA to report these issues very quickly, and I will say, if I have to pull a very modicum of success, the last time that there was an attempted sexual crime, the student body was alerted in 3 hours.
Mm-hmm.
as opposed to 3 days in other situations. So I have to say that they are taking it seriously, more seriously than they are before. That is comforting to the Harringtons, as they spoke about this past Sunday at the plaque that was placed in memoriam for Morgan on the Copley Bridge there. But they still don't have an arrest in her case. And having worked so heavily on it, my team and myself over the last year, we feel, as you know, haughty as it's going to sound, we feel pretty comfortable. We know who's involved.
Well, let's hope there is some a resolvement of this case. I hate to use that term closure because they're never closed, but at least for the family, let's take this thing to court. Blink from Blink on Crime, as always, thank you, ma'am.
Thank you. Have a good evening.
Take care. Bye-bye.
You too.
Okay, that's Blink from Blink on Crime. Always a pleasure having her on the air. We're going to take a break, and we're going to be back with victims advocate Susan Murphy Milano here on the Dana Pretzer Show. Okay, we're back. I happen to be looking at an article at the Women in Crime blog. It's an article back from September 2nd. Oklahoma, where crime blows like the wind. And I love that title, and I love my next guest, Susan Murphy Milano. You know her as a domestic violence expert and author, and she's down in Oklahoma, actually, as we speak, working on a couple of cases, actually three cases, and we're going to follow up after we're done with Susan, with Joe Turner, the father of one of these victims. And let's bring on Susan to talk about Oklahoma, where crime blows like the wind. Hi, Susan. Welcome back.
Thank you. You know, I didn't realize when I did that title of that post how much crime blows like the wind up here.
You know what? When I read it, and you got the little picture of the Oklahoma movie, but really, it's you know, we were just talking about Ohio a while ago on the show, and the problems that state has had. But here we got a state that is unbelievable. And talking about Chandra Turner, Sheila Davini, and others.
Tom Horton. I mean, these,
Tom Horton,
there's a lot
yeah.
of medical examiner cases, but the three that I've pulled out are now being called the Garvin County 3, DHT, which is domestic homicide, basically terrorism, Davini, Horton, and Turner. And these three cases are horrific. They are part of the medical examiner's case. Each case, no autopsy at one time or another, suicide on the death certificates, they are branded like cattle. It is a throwback to a place and time I have never, ever seen in my life. If you thought that the civil rights issue was a big deal, to me it's been just the same. There's been no justice for these families, for Shonda Turner, for Sheila Davini, for Tom Horton. And in each case, they have literally been denied justice. You know, we don't see this. We watch these shows. You know, we listen to yours, Jane Velez Mitchell and Nancy Grace. We see these. And we think, oh, my goodness, they're so lucky that they get coverage. These people have been fighting and at risk to their lives. A lot of the families have been threatened with their lives. A lot of these families have been told, we're not doing anything. The evidence has been collected since I have been here, besides what was here, you can hear my voice. I mean, it is truly a branding of justice I have never, ever seen. It's their own, Oklahoma style.
Let's talk about the cases individually, if we could. Let's start with Chandra Turner.
Chandra Turner was a young girl, 23 years old. She, her injury was not life-threatening, Dana. She was shot. She had 35 minutes. They could have called the paramedics, could have called 911. It was when her lung loaded up with blood. She was leaving the relationship, as we've seen in many of these cases. She was ending it. She was preparing to move out. A gun went off. She fought. You could see it through the blood throughout the house, through the back of the house. And she also did something that we got evidence for while I was here that no one knows about. And to me, that's going to be a cincher, and I'm not able to say what this is, but she fought even to do something that will prove person responsible did this. Plus, the person responsible, their family, their streets named after this person's family. There's parks. there's buildings. They own this town. What's interesting in all three cases is there's a pattern of conduct in each one. You have two to three of the same officers in 2000, 2004, and 2008. The Sheila Davini case in 2004, going through a divorce. Again, as we've seen, she's going through for orders of protection. There's a custody issue. She's got two children. They're going back and forth. He doesn't pay child support. There are warrants out against him. He's a star high school and college player. You know, in Oklahoma here, they don't touch their college players. I don't care if they're 99 years old.
Yeah.
In that case, again, and it was four people, in my opinion, that killed her. One was the person that was formerly, in my opinion, married to her. The other three people, again, because of the witness accounts we've taken, we have videotaped them. We have got affidavits. Just we're using some of the stuff in my book, Time's Up, as we would if a woman escaped, because these people have been threatened. And we've got that on tape. We've got it witnessed and notarized, just in case. And she was, you know, he was threatening just before. People heard him say different things. The accelerant used in the house. She was beaten to death and then set on fire. Nothing left. I was down taking crime scene photos in what was left of the frame of the home near a river that they used to, you know, block for flooding and things. And I was able to catch a couple of pictures there. But nothing was left. And it wasn't until sometime after that a marshal was in there and they determined, after they said accidental, that the cause of death was homicide. And they never arrested this guy. Again, you know, connections, the state. And then you have Tom Horton, a teacher, beloved, who is, a building is named after this man. Honor. His two sons have been fighting as well. The crime scene, the house. Unbelievable amount of evidence still left there. Even blood at certain parts in the wall, maybe 35 feet away. Again, a grand jury, misinformation, all three crime scenes tampered with to make it look like something else. Again, three full sets of officers in over a 3-year or a 10-year period. The crime scenes are exactly the same, exactly, as far as, you know, screwing them up and so many things. And then out here, it looks like I have two extra murders. Dana, two additional to these three that are now attached to these two cases. And I had said on another show yesterday, I said, I hope they enjoy Christmas and New Year's, because that family and that lovely life that they've had, you know, it's about to be over, because I'm going to Washington when I leave here.
Susan Murphy Milano's here. There are more links to these cases we're talking about in the show notes, so make sure you click on them. Let's talk about the sheriff.
Actually, the sheriff is running for office. To me, you know, on a tombstone, it doesn't say what somebody is. It's born and died. And this person was on all three crime scenes. As a matter of fact, on one of them, it shows you signed in and out twice. And his, you know, two of his deputies, allegedly, were on all three crime scenes. On the Turner's case, Shonda's case, it's interesting to note that somebody that died a few months before the crime scene on that case, and there was a relation to the Turner case, was recreated or mocked up, if you will, to look like something else. And it's so specific and related to Turner, it's just devastating to me. On the Horton case, the things that were done, again, all set up. One of the sheriffs that were there that night, he was best friends with one of the alleged killers, as far as I'm concerned. It was related to Horton. They were, you know, together. They were committing a crime in their teenage years, which was a felony. And he was probably protecting his buddy. And so, again, you've got three separate cases, the Garvin County three, out of many, many cases where the medical examiner stamps inappropriately whatever the heck they want, whatever, you know, strikes their fancy. And they're, to me, doing this like cattle down here.
And if you stay tuned to the show tonight, I'm going to have Shonda Turner's dad on, Joe Turner, in about 7 minutes. Now, Susan...
10 years, Dana, 10 years for justice. If you would have looked It's just the crime scene photos on their face. Robin Sachs was prosecuted yesterday.
Yeah.
Everybody would prosecute this case yesterday. But in addition to having all this, the prosecutor's office refuses to meet with me, saying that there's, you know, no new evidence. Well, look at the old evidence. It still applies. Based on what I have, an eighth of it, it would go. But the hostility down here, today was the first day it was actually better. And I want to thank everybody because they've been following what we've been doing. They've been paying attention. We have some people from Homeland Security that are now down with me 24/7. That's what this took. And, you know, because I was told I would never make it out of here unless it was a body bag. And that was a Women in Crime post that I wrote about last week. I said, by the time you read this, I'm in Oklahoma and told I will not leave here.
What about the media, Susan? Have they been helping?
Some have. You know, I call into the Ross Show, Dr. Lori Ross Show, every day. It's the amount of time that I can do. I can do 2 hours, 1 hour, but every day now at 6 o'clock on the hour, I call in what's going on. I call in a report because somebody else needs to watch as well. This is a hostile environment in a lot of ways. For the most part, Oklahoma is great. The people are great. People are coming out. We walked into O'Reilly's parts store because Mr. Turner's son had been in there grabbing something for his car, and they were talking about the Ross Show and this poor woman and where is she and let's watch her back. I went in there and we took a picture just to, you know, let it be known I'm around, I'm there. I'm doing book signings. This is also National Domestic Violence Awareness Month.
Right.
Although they threatened one of the churches that I was at on Sunday evening for a rally called Time's Up because they thought that that's what I was here to say, Time's Up, but they didn't know if they had read, they would have realized that's in my book. And that all I'm trying to do is educate. Mr. Turner was at the Gazette today asking them to do another story, and somebody said, well, we did one last week. He goes, no, you don't understand. You got her here right now. Tell people how they can get out and get help. That's what he wants to do in addition to, because he doesn't want to see any father or mother or relative or friend, you know, wind up like a Venus Stewart, wind up like a Catherine Savio or a Stacey Peterson, wind up in particular like his daughter or Sheila DeVinny or Tom Horton.
Susan Murphy Milano is here, and we're talking about Oklahoma and the lack thereof of investigation. And just before I let you go, Susan, and you brought it up, and I was going to bring it up anyway, it is Domestic Violence Awareness Month. Your quick thoughts on that before I let you go.
Quick thoughts. Go to SafeRelationships.com magazine, which I'm now part of the Institute for Relational Harm. Get yourself armed with information so you can get out, do an evidentiary abuse affidavit, and do the video so that in cases like this, had every one of these folks had one of these, we wouldn't be talking about it, and the people responsible would be prosecuted.
The cases are Chandra Turner, Sheila DeVinny, and Tom Horton, and Susan Murphy Milano and her team are on top of them, and we'll stay in touch with Susan. Thanks, Suze. Stay safe down there.
I will. Thank you very much.
Okay. Bye-bye. That's Susan Murphy Milano, and we're going to take a very quick break and come back with the father of Chandra Turner, who we were just talking about, who was shot to death at her home in Pulse Valley, Oklahoma, on July 12, 2000. And once her case investigated properly, we'll get Mr. Turner's thoughts on that here in a minute on the Dana Pretzer Show. We'll be right back. Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. And following up with the segment we just did with Susan Murphy Milano, I have on the line Joe Turner. His daughter, Chandra, was just 23 years old when she was shot to death at her home in Pauls Valley, Oklahoma, on July 12th, 2000. Here to talk about that case and Domestic Violence Awareness Month is her dad. Joe, welcome to the show, sir.
Thank you. I'm glad to be there.
And again, there is never words enough for victims of crime, their families of victims of crime, and our condolences go to you and your family and the loss of your daughter. We just spent 15 minutes with Susan Murphy Milano talking about the case, the investigation or lack thereof, I guess. Fill us in a little bit from the perspective of a father.
Where do we want to start at? From the time it started, from the time it happened, or where do we want to start at?
Let's go right from when the time it started.
Okay. When they said that she was killed around between 10:30 and 11 that night, it was 6 o'clock the next morning before we was notified anything had happened.
Mm-hmm.
She was already in a funeral home. It had already been ruled suicide. There was no autopsy. They have told us the most ridiculous things. When I seen her in the funeral home, the first thing I seen was a bruise on her fist where she'd been fighting.
Right.
We got to look, and she had bruises from her neck to her toes. I mean, she was beat up. She fought hard. And we called the Oklahoma Death Investigator back. I'll just say her name, John Miller from Ardmore. He came back, and he looked at her, and he said, well, I don't deny she was in a fight, Mr. Turner, but it had nothing to do with her death. That's the type of justice we've got up here. There was no investigation done on my daughter's case. They tried to sweep it under the rug and told us the most ridiculous things, but we didn't fall for it. We immediately went on the defensive. We took photographs of my daughter in the casket. We opened the casket up. We let people see all the bruises so we'd have witnesses for later time, you know. And we've continued to seek justice. And you know, this is domestic abuse. And people need to be aware of it.
Now, I'm not totally familiar with Oklahoma law, but I'm curious when you say that there was no autopsy. Were you, as her father, able to demand an autopsy, or was that strictly the call of the coroner?
Strictly the call of the ME's office.
Medical.
We have got several letters where we was denied.
Hmm.
We asked for one before we buried her, asked several times afterwards. Finally, last December, we finally got a court order. We got an attorney that got a court order to have her body exhumed. We also had Dr. Bucks from Colorado Springs, which is the coroner out there. He's the medical examiner from Colorado Springs. We flew him in, and in the court order, he was to observe and participate with the ME from Oklahoma, which was Dr. Collie Trant. We exhumed her body. They did the autopsy. Within 30 minutes of the autopsy, they called our attorney and said, bring us everything you've got.
Uh-huh.
After the autopsy, it was ruled they were going to change the death certificate from suicide to homicide. And they told us, they told Mashburn, they told Cherokee Ballard, they told one more from Tom Jordan that was on the medical examiner's board.
Right.
But Dr. Trant, he says he has to go to Louisiana, anyway, somewhere out of state to take care of some business. When he gets back, we're going to have a news conference. Give us our amended death certificate and all this and that. Well, the medical examiner board fired him, and we still don't have our amended death certificate. But the ME's office did send us a report. Their report came out. The date of death was, or the date of birth, her date of birth was wrong. The date of death was wrong. The time that the medical examiner showed up, if she'd had laid up in the yard for 24 hours, which she didn't, before he showed up. And now she's been hit with a heavy truck.
Mm.
And the stamp that was used on this report that came out, the man hadn't worked there. Channel 25, the news channel, verified it. He hadn't worked there in years.
You know, I'm beyond words. Joe Turner is here talking about the death of his daughter. Now, Susan Murphy Milano made the statement that when she tried to get the DA to talk to her, she was denied, saying that there's no new evidence. And Susan, in the way that she says it so accurately, well, what about the old evidence? And I ask you that, sir, what about the old evidence, and what is the DA telling you?
The DA will not. We went and seen the DA, and that's what he told us, that there wasn't, you know, this was before the autopsy, but, you know, that there wasn't enough evidence there to prosecute. Well, since we've had the autopsy, both pathologists, which they will not take anything they say, you know, that's not new evidence to them, because Dr. Trant, they fired him, and Dr. Bucks is from Colorado. Well, he can't write a death certificate in Oklahoma.
Right.
So they're considering this not new evidence, but from the autopsy, both of them said she could live from 30 to 45 minutes before she died. You know, she filled, her lungs filled up with blood and she choked to death.
Oh.
So is what's happened.
What a tragedy. Joe Turner's on the... Yeah.
But, sir, our attorney says that second-degree murder charges can be filed right now because they didn't get her to the hospital. They let her lay there and die, you know.
Right. And what response are you getting from the sheriff's department?
Zero. There is no... They won't... It's suicide. They're not going to open up a suicide case.
How they come...
Susan, she has done tremendous help here in Garvin County. I mean, she's trying to bring everybody aware of domestic abuse, which we're getting great response from the public. I mean, but the law enforcement they're scared. They don't want to talk to us. The DA doesn't want to talk to us. There's no response there, but we are working on getting the laws changed. In Oklahoma, there is no appeals court for the ME's office. What they say is, it's like God, you know, they think their word's like God's word, which it isn't, but there's no appeals process. If you have questions over your death certificate, there's no appeal system. And we've collected signatures. I'm fixing to start going to the state capitol. We've got several representatives on our side now to get an appeal system set up so people can go up in front of the board. If they have questions with their death certificate, you don't get the answers you want there, you can go ahead and appeal it to a district judge up there and let a judge rule over it.
Now, with it being, Joe Turner is here talking about the death of his daughter, Chandra, with it being Domestic Violence Awareness Month, Joe, what message do you have for my audience?
If you know someone in an abusive relationship, get them out of it. I mean, any way you can, get them out of it. I heard today, I visited some with Susan today and I heard her speak. You know, write it down. Get it. Write down what's going on. Who's threatening you? Get it wrote down. Get it. Can't even think now. Get it notarized. Get it. You know, get something that'll hold up in court so they're not in my shape. You know it. But these girls and men, if they're in an abusive relationship, they need to get out and at whatever expense, get out of it. Because I don't want my enemies going through what me and my wife have.
When you, if you had a chance today, sir, to sit down with the governor of Oklahoma, what would you tell him or her?
I would ask him if he has children, and I would ask him, what would you do if this was your child? Would you change the laws? Would you set up an appeals system? What would you do if this was your daughter? And that's what all these lawmakers needs to ask themselves. What if it was my daughter, my wife, my son, whoever? How would they feel? You know, they need to put themselves back into thinking like a common resident of Oklahoma or United States, wherever. This can happen to them just like this has happened to me. That's why we've got to get the laws changed.
To prevent another tragedy like the one with your daughter.
Yes. I mean, there's women, children getting killed every day.
Right.
And it seems like people's closing their eyes to it instead of getting out there. People's going to have to get up off the couch and get back involved in the government. And, sir, I work in the oil field. I'm not no speaker. I would have never thought I'm doing what we're doing today, but me and the wife, our daughter fought so hard to stay alive.
Yeah.
We're not going to let her be branded with suicide when she fought so hard to stay alive.
Well, you deserve justice, your family, and of course, Chandra, Joe.
Yes.
Listen, for everyone listening live or on the podcast, we do have links in the show notes to learn more about Chandra and her case, and of course, Sheila Deviney and Tom Horton. Joe, I'll give you the last word.
Yes, sir. Just go to www.justicefortheDead.com and just read it. Just there late. There's every place you can go, see what all's been going on. But people, we're going to have to stand up and start doing what's right. That's my last thought to people, goes.
Okay.
I was guilty of it, too. You know, I didn't get involved, you know. Well, I didn't know nothing about who I was voting for. We need to check these people out that's going into state government and know how they stand on things. We got to start making our lawmakers credible. I mean, they can't just be, because they had more money, why we put them in there. They've got to go in there and start doing their jobs.
I agree completely. Accountability is so important. Joe Turner, thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. That's another case, and we'll keep covering it here on Scared Monkeys Radio as news breaks on it. Anyway, that's it. That's tonight's show. If you missed part of it or want to hear it or others, you can go to the website at scaredmonkeysradio.com to pick up podcasts of past shows, daily commentaries, etc. Make sure and check out the main page at scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for joining me. We'll see you again real soon.
Been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guest websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening.